The following program is an abridged audio version of the streaming video talk show, A Wonderful Chaos. The hosts are Andy Chaliff and Bambos Dimitriou. The format is entirely casual, unscripted conversation. If you'd like to watch a live taping or participate with your comments in real time, subscribe to A Wonderful Chaos on YouTube, Facebook, Periscope, or Twitch.
So I was diagnosed with dwarfism the day that I was born. My parents, who are not little people, they knew something was up, but they did not know that I had dwarfism when I was in the womb. It was hard. People with dwarfism have historically been portrayed in negative ways in the media as leprechauns, elves, and all different characters. So they didn't really have a positive portrayal to reference, and it took just trying to find books everywhere possible. This was before the internet was readily available, and they were just exhausted and still confused after 6 months. So my dad will admit that he struggled to just keep a good mindset for those first 6 months of my life because he wanted to do everything he could to figure out how to give me a good life.
It's a wonderful chaos, beautifully random, messy and glorious,
solo or tandem.
We work to find rest. Fight to find peace, both head and the heart.
Like a nephew and niece.
What are we doing here?
You mean listening to this show?
Where the more that you learn is the less that you know. Where the wounded are healers
and the atheists pray.
It's a wonderful chaos, and we like it that way. It's a wonderful chaos, and we like it that way. It's a wonderful chaos, and we like it that way.
We are on today, Bambos,
with Becky Kuran-Kakula.
Nicely said, Becky Kuran-Kakula. She is a dwarf.
It sounds like a cocktail.
It does. We're going to discuss life as a dwarf.
And we're going to do that, Andy, on?
A Wonderful Chaos.
Where?
A Wonderful Chaos.
I don't hear you.
A Wonderful Chaos.
I kind of miss being on the show over the weekend.
Do you?
Yeah.
I kind of thank God. I'm glad I got 2 days off. We've been pushing it. I mean, to think that since COVID began, outside a little break we took in the middle, this is crazy, Bambos. How many shows? 125 shows.
Yeah.
Say 130 if we count the ones that we didn't actually number yet. That's a lot of shows to have done in less than a year, just on the
March, April, May, June, yeah. July, August.
It's crazy.
September.
And so what happened for me was I went through all my friends, right? I went through all my high school teachers. And then I started to found these sort of nice websites where people say, hey, I'd be interested in coming on a show. On Facebook, they have groups. And I found Becky on that group. And it just sounded like that would be fun just to have a talk to dig into a life that's very different. And I would propose very different. We'll have to see. But just to kind of hear and understand what are the differences, what are the prejudices. And it was really quite funny because, like, I book, say, 30 shows in a very short time.
He does.
So I get on. I start posting. You ready? You want to get on? And then I start writing. And then, like, the copy text I write for a show, usually I don't give it much thought, right? So I just write it quick because I got to get through a lot of these things and I don't have a lot of time in my brain to do that. So I wrote it. And, like, the first things I wrote for Becky's show were, like, pathetic cliches, you know? Like, you know, I don't even remember what the text was, but it was something just absurd. Just like the typical thing that after having read it, I was embarrassed that I'd ever written it.
What did you write?
I wrote something like, although she's a dwarf, she's, you know, living up to some tall expectation or some stupid shit that the kind of like low hanging stupid things that people would write just because it's like the stereotype is easy to write. And it just perpetuates these stupid ideas. But, you know, I wasn't thinking. And then she wrote back and she wrote something. She was really nice about it. She's sort of like, Andy, let's just say high aspirations. She just corrected me in a really nice way. But after having written it and having to correct, like, think to myself, oh, my God, she's thinking to herself, you know, another idiot I've got to have a discussion with. But it was really fun because, as you know, I don't take myself all that seriously. So I kind of thought, what a beautiful segue into the show. Because in a way, you know, that's the kind of nonsense that I'm sure she has to deal with all the time. So it's also cool to hear from her perspective how it is to deal with people like me in the world. and people that maybe don't even have as much consciousness as I do to think that, you know, it's not as big a deal as maybe others might make it out to be, you know? Yeah. And we're going to talk to her about, she does a lot of motivational speaking, and she works for a company called Disability Inn. And she'll discuss that with us as well, where they're bringing consciousness to people working within businesses with disabilities and helping companies find matches, given that the rate of unemployment for people with disabilities is double that of people without. So that's one of these causes that she's working and a spokesperson for. Nice.
Nice.
So that was kind of, that was my, and like for the talk and the subject, I wanted it to be fun and interesting. And I can always kind of tell how willing a person coming on is to like have a fun topic, like allows me to say, okay, it's going to be a nice show. So when I said, oh, I'm a dwarf, I think I wrote so, or get over it. And that was sort of a beautiful entry, because in some weird ways on this show, I think I like to celebrate the fact that if we look behind the curtain of what we have as a projection onto something, we'll see that we're all always the same anyways. So stop thinking you're all that different, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. That was that. How are you?
Yes, I had a tough weekend, and when I saw the show, it kind of cheered me up.
Which show?
Oh, for today.
Oh,
like something different, and getting. I look forward to coming on the Wonderful Chaos.
Yeah,
I really meant it. Like I think because you're married and you have someone to socialize with. I don't have that in my life.
Yeah.
Like I've pretty much cut out a lot of connections because of COVID. And it does eat me away. Yeah.
And so this is your time in a day when you can connect.
Yeah, definitely.
Wow. Beautiful.
What's happening to you?
I just find it beautiful. I think we've done 125 shows and I'm getting a little bit sick of it. I'm a bit like, you know, it felt like I was focused, like I was active. I think the book, I was so running so fast and hard for the launch of the book that this fit into it. And now I feel like self-love, the core of the book, feels like more what I want than activity. And so there's a little bit of a moment in me at the moment where it just says, you know, just be loving nothing. You know, I keep feeling like I want to be at peace with the process of dying. Like that's where I always want to be. I don't want to be attaching. I want to be feeling like, oh, wow, it's okay. I can let go of that. I can let go of that. I can let go of that. And it feels like in running to do something like the book, you're attaching to stuff. You're like getting. And then in the end, you're like, oh, okay, it's done now. And there's a little bit of a, sometimes it's been hard for me to separate that in my own life. You know?
Yeah, you've really been busy.
I've been busy.
Almost every waking hour.
And right? To think about organizing 125 shows, like, although it was relatively easy for me, it still was a lot of work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Time.
I think it'd be nice to bring Becky on now. Hey, Becky.
I felt like I was in yoga class.
Yeah.
Doing some deep breathing.
Yeah, sometimes we have quiet moments. We're just trying to...
We just do that for Bumbos.
No. I wouldn't necessarily do it myself, but it certainly grounds the conversation.
Yeah.
I can run really fast talking, and sometimes Bumbos says, Andy, take a breath. And then we get an opportunity to connect again. So
balance each other out.
So I think I asked you this question. I think it's good to start off with it again. When did you actually contract dwarfism?
You can't get more offensive than that.
No, I honestly would love to know, are there people that would actually honestly ask you that question?
Probably, but I've never been asked the question before in that way.
Yeah.
When you say not in that way, do you mean in the
in
like,
other ways?
Like you can feel that there's a love there. You can feel the intention behind it, right?
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. So I was diagnosed with dwarfism the day that I was born. And the only way that was able to happen was because a nurse in the delivery room at the hospital where I was born had seen someone like me be born with the same type of dwarfism before. There are over 400 types of dwarfism, wow. And my type is the most common, which is achondroplasia. And if it wasn't for that nurse, it probably would have taken a lot longer for my parents, who are not little people, to find out that I had dwarfism. They knew something was up, but they did not know that I had dwarfism when I was in the womb.
Wow. Would they know that now because of testing, or is it always something you find out afterwards?
Absolutely. So this was back in 1984, and I think there's just been a lot more advanced testing that has happened, and it may even be able to become available at the 11-week ultrasound, but I'm not sure exactly when people are able to pinpoint it at this point in time, but definitely a lot earlier.
And do you know what the nurse specifically noticed? Are there things that you say, oh, these were the key indicators that you could tell that someone might have dwarfism at that point?
Whenever I try to explain to kids in school, I say that I looked like a caricature, but it's a little over-exaggerating where it's like my head was larger than the rest of my body.
Okay.
But if you look at some newborn pictures, you may not think it's as exaggerated as that. But we are known to have larger heads than your average person. So when you were talking about hats earlier, I get anxiety around baseball hats because I don't know whether it's going to fit or not. I have to always go the beanie route.
I didn't realize that. So you would have a larger head than just a person, just whatever, just whatever the term would be.
The average. Yeah.
The average Joe. Per Joe. Wow.
It's definitely specific to achondroplasia, the type of dwarfism I have. So there may be other people that don't have it that also have dwarfism. But sometimes it is an assumption that you have extra fluid in your head.
Okay.
So you really have to watch to make sure the circumference isn't too big. There was one time, you guys would get a kick out of this story. My father found out that my head was bigger than it needed to be, and they thought it was because of the extra fluid and that I needed to get a shunt, which is a very scary process. But people with dwarfism have had that experience many times.
What is a shunt? I don't know what that is.
A shunt is like a little piece of hardware they put in your head to like drain the fluid.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Extra fluid. And we went to a specialist who was the doctor I went to growing up. And he said that my head was too big and something was going to have to happen. And then we drive from Baltimore to New Jersey, take a stop in Philadelphia. My dad threw up on the Liberty Bell because he was so nervous. And then we go to the other doctor, and she said that the first doctor measured my head wrong and we didn't have to go through with the shunt. Jesus. But you just have to be very... look carefully. So that was a piece. And then I have enough skin to be, because I have an average height torso and shorter arms and legs. I have enough skin to almost be an average height person. So they could tell that I had like extra skin, but shorter bones.
And that extra skin, does it impact you in any way? I mean, is it like...
just makes us look chubbier.
Okay. So your skin will be thicker then.
Yeah.
That means you don't age easily.
Right. I look like a kid at all times.
So you were born in 84.
Yes.
Yeah. So how was it for your parents to discover that you were having dwarfism?
It was hard. They had not, as you all know, people with dwarfism have historically been portrayed in negative ways in the media as leprechauns, elves, and all different characters. So they didn't really have a positive portrayal to reference at that point in time.
Wow.
And my dad's brother was actually very knowledgeable in the medical field, and all he could find was a brochure to send to my dad. So my dad's like, even my brother, who knows so much about the medical field, can't even find much information. And it took just trying to find books everywhere possible. This was before the internet was readily available, and they found out just through word of mouth that there was a specialist doctor down in Baltimore. So I grew up in the Boston area. We went to some doctors in the Boston area to get consultation, but they really didn't have the answers that my parents were looking for. And then my parents decided to sign me up for a sleep study at this doctor in Baltimore. And once we got to Baltimore, it allowed us, because I did the sleep study, to get an appointment with this doctor who had a very long waiting list.
Okay.
And he saw the look on my parents' face when they got there, and they were just exhausted and still confused after 6 months. So my dad will admit that he struggled to just keep a good mindset for those first 6 months of my life, because he wanted to do everything he could to figure out how to give me a good life. And when that doctor saw them and the look on their face, even though the waiting room was full, he brought them into the office and just gave them all enough answers that made them feel comfortable to move forward with supporting me in the best way possible. And really what they learned was they should treat me just like they do my older sister, who's average height, and let me fall if things are going to happen. I try to just integrate me into the community, allow me to play sports, go to school. And there were medical complications that came with it. So that doctor just kept a close eye as I was growing up to address my medical needs before they could become more worrisome as an adult.
And what kind of issues would come up?
When I was two-ish, they had me in a back brace to make sure my body would stay aligned as I was growing. And then when I was three, I had bone taken out of both of my legs because I was bow-legged. So I was like, and then that was ruining the alignment of my back. So I had the bone taken out. And then when I was 13, I had bone put back in my legs when I was almost finished growing. And then it was the summer before my 10th grade year in high school, I lost my ability to walk. I thought it was just because I was sailing and wearing a wetsuit that I thought was really tight, but it was that I was having spinal cord compression where my spinal column was up really close to my spinal cord and pinching the nerve. And I just kept falling every time I would try to walk. So I had 7 pieces of my lower vertebrae removed during the fall of that year. And I was, the thing I was the most devastated about was missing school. I know I needed to have the surgery, but I was more fearful of falling behind because I was so used to trying to keep up with all my peers up until that point.
Yeah.
And it was necessary. And I haven't had a surgery since that at age 15. I'm 36 now. So it worked, but it was just always trying to figure out how I could prevent falling behind. And I think just in general, a lot of people with disabilities worry about that, falling behind, and don't want to fall behind. And same with disclosure in the workplace. People are fearful. If I share that I have to go have surgery, people aren't going to take me seriously. I'm not going to get this job. And probably same thing if someone comes up with an illness. People don't take you seriously because they think that you're going to just cash out or not be as motivated to do the work.
Yeah. Like, I know how hard it was for me to feel like I belonged with all of, like, nothing really to all that worry about, per se, right? Meaning physically, I was okay. Mentally, I was, you know, functioning well. So I just think to myself, how would it have been for you to go through grade school, go through high school, to always have been different in your class, even to the point where noticeably different? It was like not like you could go anywhere without anyone actually either, and especially young kids who haven't built any sense of understanding of like difference at that moment. It's more like they might even point and then, you know, you would be just objectified or something. How was that for you growing up like that, or having that around you, I'm assuming?
When you were saying, I'm trying to imagine growing up with those different experiences, I often, at least as an adult, try to catch people and be like, your experience is your experience. Your challenge is your challenge.
Sure.
We all face challenges in different ways. And I think I was just equipped because I had the support from my family growing up to, I guess, build. It took time, but to build a shield. Every time people would remind me that I was different, I would just be like, if I let it get to me every single time someone reminds me, then I would be destroyed. And I think it's just trying to keep that level headset, but it didn't happen right away. It took time. And especially after I had my back surgery in high school, a lot of my friends started dating, a lot of my close girlfriends, and they just didn't really think that I could be around because maybe I would prevent, I don't know, just the, being different. It could be hard for me to fit in those co-ed environments. It was kind of the assumption, and it did destroy me. I was very upset for a long time because I just kind of lost the social life that I was used to. And I had to figure out how to rebuild and find those people who would be okay with me hanging out with them during a very vulnerable time after I came back from surgery, just trying to fit back in. And then my parents, super supportive, but in high school, you don't want to just be at home or go to the movies with your parents. And I think it was during that time that I also learned that I need to figure out how to go out and do things that I want to do and not wait around for people, and the rest will follow. And I just kind of built that sense of independence from that experience and thought, I'm not going to wait around to think like, what do they think? Or I should only do it this way or that way. I need to just go. And that's kind of what motivated me after college to move from the East Coast to the West Coast to just figure out how to build a life in a place that I wasn't used to around. One of the motivators that got me to move out to California after college was that there were other little people who I was very close with. I didn't get involved in the little people organization until college because I didn't think that I need to be around anyone with dwarfism because I was used to being the only one with dwarfism in my environment. And that's kind of how it is in everyday life. But there was something special about the people I met who happened to live out in California, who I stayed very closely connected to through my college years. And it really helped my sanity because I realized that I wasn't alone and other people experienced those experiences.
That surprises me, what you just said, because in some ways I'm thinking to myself, if I go through high school and I'm not feeling like I'm in a crowd that's accepting of who I am, then it's easier to find a crowd of similar people so that I don't need to like prove myself because we're all basically suffering or having whatever experiences we're having. So it's amazing that you went so long without gravitating towards other people with dwarfism.
Right. It was, it took having a convention. There's a convention every year when there's not a pandemic in person, and they try to do it in the US, East Coast, West Coast, middle of the country, just so it can be affordable for different groups of people throughout the 3-year span. And there was one happening in Boston after my freshman year in college, and my parents knew a family that was planning to go. So it really took even like them convincing us, come check this out, it's happening in your backyard. And I don't know if it wasn't in Boston that year, it could have been even later that I got involved. Mm. And I was still hesitant that first year. I went to the convention a few days in and out. I didn't stay at the hotel where it was happening, just kind of dunk my foot a little bit in the water.
Wow.
And it took having people over the course of the next year just convince me the importance of staying engaged. And by the next summer, I was hooked, and every spring break and any opportunity I had to travel, I would go hang out with people. Mm. But I also learned there are a lot of people who I have nothing in common with.
Yeah, of course.
Doesn't mean we're going to be best friends.
Isn't that the best? Everyone just kind of assumed, like, I lived overseas all the time. And wherever I lived anywhere, everyone was like, don't you hang out with all your American friends? Like, I lived in Japan, a little village, and there were, you know, a few Americans. And I'd be like, you know, I don't want to hang out with any of those people. What makes you think I'd get along with those idiots, you know?
I always say it hasn't happened yet, but I always say it would be fun to go to a restaurant where there are other little people who I don't know anything about. And the waitress will say, oh, your friends are over there. And then I can react like those aren't the, like, in reality, those aren't the people I'm here to see.
How was it dating? Because at some point, like, would you have ever gone out on a date with anyone that wasn't a dwarf? Right. And then if so, like, how would that have played out? Like, how was your life progressively in that domain?
That's a great question. So I'm currently married to a person with dwarfism, but growing up, I did not, especially since I didn't get involved in the Little People organization until college, I didn't really have a preference, but I wanted the person to have the right intentions. And I think sometimes people assume people with dwarfism, because we look like kids, we won't be as aware of what's going on, that like fetishes exist. They're a real thing. And like we read about them and we hear about them, and we have to be super cautious about those things so we don't get ourselves in unsafe situations. So it takes like really having to build a level of trust. And I've found that those people that I've been able to trust the most are people that have an experience with adversity in their own life. So if there are average height guys, they either have a sibling who may have a difference or a friend. And it takes kind of sharing that story for you to be like, okay, they get it. I could trust them a little bit more. But I never like actually like was in a relationship with someone who was average height. And it was no, like, not that I didn't want to be, but it just didn't play out.
Yeah.
So I went on dates with people, but they never ended in a good scenario, even after going through that filter stage. I never felt in jeopardy, but it just, I struggled to trust people with that knowledge.
Yeah. That was weird. I wouldn't have ever thought that. I mean, I'm kind of disgusted as you're speaking, thinking that that would be a state you'd even have to worry about. And yeah, like how do you become aware that this exists in the world? Like, does someone warn you about it? Like, is someone like, you have to be worried because this sort of stuff happens?
Yeah, there are people who've like showed up to Little People conventions and have to get kicked out because they like try to sign up and register you're kind of aware that it exists. And similar things happen to other disabilities. There's a wheelchair group. Like, there's just, it's weird.
Yeah, no, okay. We don't need to go there. But now I know. Yeah. I don't want to necessarily look this up afterwards. It's just, this is the depravity of like, get a life and move on and, you know, do something with your life. God.
Right.
Okay.
It's crazy. But
meet your husband. And you meet him at one of these sort of conventions. Where do you meet him?
We actually did not. So I did date a few people who I met at conventions. And with Little People, in most cases, the person you decide to date who you meet at a convention does not live in the city you live in. So you're also facing the long distance until you can figure out how to combine your lives. So I did meet someone. My first relationship was, I think, 2009. So I was in my 20s before I had like a first real relationship. And then we did distance for a year, and then we lived together for 6 months. Didn't go well. Nice. Then I had two other relationships that were distance the whole time, but we would plan visits. But a lot of those visits, because everyone has full-time jobs, or 5 nights. So they always say it's like honeymoon phase until you actually meet someone. And meeting my husband was actually through Facebook. I was living in New York at the time. I had a friend who told me people she had talked to recently, but she wasn't talking to them anymore. And I just decided to add him on Facebook, and we started talking. We did distance for 4 months before meeting, and then he came to visit me in New York. And then we did those 5-night trips every month, month and a half. And when I got the job at the organization where I work now, it was a fully remote job. This was about 3 years ago. Mm. It allowed me to move to where he lived to figure out if we could stand each other.
Yeah, that's how it works, isn't it?
Yeah. And then I actually, we got engaged right before I moved. So we also knew that that would happen. And I had visited for longer periods of time after I got that remote job. So we didn't just like
dive
right in. But
we trust you. We trust you have good judgment, Becky. You don't have to justify yourself. Yeah. We trust you.
But Facebook, again, it was one of those things that was fully trust. And we had a whole plan for when he would visit me in New York. If things didn't go well, we'd plan out a hotel. But it was a safer, it felt safer right away, knowing that we had that connection versus trying to meet a stranger who was retired, who you don't know what the intentions were.
Yeah. Hmm. You said there was 400 different types of dwarfism and achondroplasia.
Achondroplasia.
Oh, Jesus. I'm really bad with pronouncing anything. Would you say, can you recognize the different forms when you meet a person? Like, do you know and say, oh, that's this form of dwarfism? Is there things that are telltale signs that you see that others wouldn't see?
I would say there's probably about maybe 10 of the 400 that I could recognize, but maybe not always be spot on. But the 390 remaining, it could be so specific to like one part of your body that's different that makes you that. But I think that those may also be the even less common. This top 10 is more common. And then it's interesting too, because some people carry the dwarfism gene on with them if they have children, and some do not based on their type of dwarfism.
Yeah.
I'm tuning into myself. Like there'll be days like let's say on Saturday, I've been feeling quite isolated, and then I go into to the organic market. I'm doing my groceries, and everyone seems to be having fun, and everyone's in groups of people, and they're socializing, and I just feel left out. And when I'm tuning into you, like this must have been a big part of your life, and not only that, like, to feel that there's eyes looking at you.
I would say, like, even when I first started going to networking events as an adult, they have not always been that inclusive, because everyone's hanging out at these high top tables and they're all networking up at a level way above me. And same with like school dances, like everyone's having a conversation up here and I'm down here. And unless it's someone who is willing to take that initiative of like, oh, let's figure out how to level out the conversation so Becky can participate. It was hard to just show up to events, even though I'm not afraid to go places alone. I would show up somewhere and be like, where do I fit in? Because the conversation is happening here. And I will say, even when I was living in New York City, I was there for 3.5 years. I would go places, and it was very hard to meet people just as friends, because they're all having conversations on different levels and just wanting to be taken seriously. It was always easier to at least know one person. I went on a trip in high school to Munich and Paris, and it was a school organized group. And the people who were organizing it said, it's okay if you don't have any close friends going on the trip. Like, it's meant to be a bonding experience with all these new people. And I found one person I kind of knew who was going, and she got in a car accident like right before. She ended up being okay, but was not able to go on the trip. And because that person wasn't going, and she was someone I knew a little bit more than the rest of the people, it made the experience even worse for me, because everyone was grouping off into their different groups. And I had to figure out, I didn't even have the support of the advisors who were taking us on the trip, whose responsibility was to make sure we were safe and okay. And there was one day I had really always wanted to go to Paris. And we had a lot of days where there were all these free hours where people could do whatever they want without the group organized events. And I just had to walk around the hotel area and see as much as I could. And now being older, I would have explored even further. But at that point in time, I thought that I'd have at least one other person to walk around with. And it was challenging. And there was no way to explain, like, How do I become part of this group that I don't fit into?
Wow.
Well, that was like, it was tough, because I took French in high school for the very reason of wanting to go to France, and I need to go back someday. But it was like, wait a minute, like I can't force these people to hang out with me. And one of the other challenges is I walk slower than people. So those people who are strangers may think that I'm just slowing them down and preventing them from doing as much as they wanted to do.
Yeah.
Finding patient people who are willing to be open.
Yeah.
Becky, would you say that back then also you didn't have the skill set to be vulnerable and just share your experience, like go up to people and say, hey, listen, I know you guys don't know me and this is what I'm experiencing right now. I could really use some human connection right now.
That is spot on. I think, and it was a combination of that. And at that point in time, I wasn't okay being alone, even though the decision was made for me. And I think about that often where I feel more confident about calling people out, but I still have to be careful. Like when I was living in New York or LA, if someone was approaching me and reminding me that I was different, even if I didn't want to be in their social circle, I had to decide, is it a teachable moment, a time to educate them? Or if I say something that may set them off, am I risking my own safety?
Mm.
So it's finding that balance.
What would be a situation that like that? Help me understand, like where you would, what would the teachable moment be?
There are often times where people think I'm crazy people on TV because there are so many reality shows right now.
Okay.
People think that I'm one of the many people on those shows, and I have not been on any of those shows. I've done interviews like this. I've done speaking videos, but I tried to say that is not me. And then I tried to figure out like, we're not all the same person.
Fuck.
Even
so
if I'm
can I give Andy some context
here? I'm getting a little bit sick to my stomach as you're speaking right now.
Andy, it would be like you not wanting to coach everyone that has an issue.
It's worse, Bambos.
It's much worse.
No, this is like, so you're telling me that there is a projection onto you of what a behavior of a dwarf is.
Yes.
And then, okay. and they interact with you in a way that is sort of almost like with the expectation and how they engage you to say, now behave accordingly.
Mm-hmm. Or they tell me I'm lying if I tell them I'm not on one of those shows. And I think in my head, like I would know if there were cameras in my face every morning and if I had a production team at my house to film these shows that I'm not in.
And then, and that's what you're saying is in those moments, yeah. You're like, you know what? I'm not going to explain to this guy or this woman. They're idiots.
Because if they're so set on the fact that I'm not going to change their mind.
No. It would be like trying to convince a Trump supporter or a Biden supporter that they should vote for the other party.
Right.
There's no winning there. No.
It sounds exhausting.
That's exhausting. Just listening to it makes me feel sick.
And so I think like I like being in big cities because there's a lot to do, but it's more prone to happen in big cities, especially New York and LA, because those are entertainment towns to begin with. People just assume. And I think that's why a lot of people with dwarfism become or try to pursue a career in acting, because they may walk around in LA or New York and someone may say, oh, you should be an actor. And then they think that that's their calling, but they don't realize that it takes a lot of hard work to continue to pursue that.
Clearly. I'm interested in a wholly another topic. And we can say yes or no to this topic, but I still have to ask. Sex. So first of all, I don't know is there complications or challenges with having children? Is there, because you mentioned all the spinal and all these. So are there issues that you'd have if you wanted to conceive? And if so, what are the kind of complications that might emerge?
It's a great question. So my husband and I both have achondroplasia, which is the most common type of dwarfism. And we both carry the achondroplasia gene, meaning if we have children, there is a very slight, meaning 25% chance where the child could be double dominant, meaning they would not live past a few days. may not even make it the full term. And in that scenario, it's known that there's amniofluid, a lot more of it, that causes it to be a heavier pregnancy, which could compromise the spine more than an average pregnancy. Hmm. And I think in general, because even though my torso is average height, my organs are more compact than just like the spinal column. They say if you are not having spinal issues going into pregnancy, you should be okay. But it kind of comes and goes at any point. So I think you may still have them regardless.
Yeah.
But there's a 25% chance where we could have a child that's average height, and then 50% chance a child with achondroplasia. And I think people just don't talk enough about, like everyone said, talks about miscarriage, like no one talks about miscarriage as much. So if you take some of the statistics and try to figure out the numbers, it may still be that the possibilities are similar to the amount of people who have miscarriages, or there it's just not talked about in society.
Yeah.
Just like we don't talk about it as much, but there's a lot to consider, and it's tough because you don't know. Some people, I have a friend who, she was sick the entire time, and some people do pursue the adoption route because especially in other countries, China specifically, a lot of children are left out on the streets, especially because of the one child policy. If your child isn't perfect, then people are left on the streets and they're brought to orphanages. And the orphanages put people with dwarfism in a room that's like the unadoptable room. So then unless someone finds a file on them, or through word of mouth, maybe an average height family goes to an orphanage to adopt someone, they tell someone back in the States with dwarfism, oh, I saw this child and I've seen you in all these Facebook groups, you may be interested. Once someone expresses interest, then the orphanage is like, oh, we're going to start to nurture them and give them a chance. But there are a lot of kids who end up getting to age 14, they age out of the orphanage, and then they're put back on the streets. And it's like never ending cycle. So there are plenty of routes. I think it's known that someone who is average height and has two parents with dwarfism, bullying may happen because people may ask like, oh, why are your parents little? Or I've heard people say, I don't know for sure, but I heard people say it's comparable to someone having two moms or two dads.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering, if it was similar to that, of course. Yeah.
But then again, like they could help the parents reach things, and I think they could grow up with a perspective that will hopefully allow them to be kind and helpful to other people.
But it's a heavy decision, obviously, in that case, given all the statistics, you just realize, I mean, you can't just like, oh, let's just do this. I mean, there's serious consequences. It's
And just the medical, just like how it took us 6 months to find a specialist in Baltimore. A lot of people aren't that fortunate to even find someone who's a specialist, and you want to make sure, like anesthesia is something that's really important to navigate. My dad canceled one of my surgeries once because the anesthesiologist was way overconfident and it didn't end up sounding like we could trust that person.
Yeah.
And that would be me risking my life because of all my organs.
Yeah.
And with having a child, someone with dwarfism most likely needs to have a C-section because it's just not, there's not enough space.
Yeah.
So that comes with anesthesia. So you would need to consider those things too.
Mm. Wow.
See, we went deep again.
This isn't deep. This is like the kind of questions that riddle in my brain of fascination. And I've got more about both. So you're going to have to butt in I have a weird question that I we talked about, we're about 15 minutes left, right? And I also want to get to disability in the company that you're working for that's heightening awareness around people with disabilities getting into work and job positions. But there's one thing that's always sort of agitated me, I guess, a little bit, but I haven't spoken it out. And it's like this broad category of disability. Because, you know, once I talk about like disability, then it becomes, I don't have any issue with the word, you know, like we use words, we need categories in life, we need to kind of give, but once it becomes so broad that there are cognitive disabilities, there's physical disabilities. And to some degree, those two, for me, they're not in any way connected to one another. One is an inability to physically work and move, and another was an inability to work and cognitively work out problems and things that you might have, or even deal with stimulus, as we'd know with people that have. So in some ways, it feels like our society isn't able to make simple distinctions, which allow us to better like just understand, oh, yeah, when we use these words, they have different implications. That's been my feeling for some time now.
And I think sometimes people also think like when they hear the word disability, they just think of someone who has no quality of life and is on their deathbed, like just like the worst of the worst. I think that's the way that people react and they don't realize that there is that range. I will share a story for when I went to Kenya in 2013. I traveled there from the States. We actually had a layover in Amsterdam, and I was advocating on behalf of an organization that was being launched for people with dwarfism in Kenya. And they were struggling so much to figure out how they could be accepted within the community in Nairobi, Kenya specifically. And the family that I traveled with had a daughter with Down syndrome, and we were all going out to do media interviews in Kenya. They got lots of press coverage everywhere, but they changed the structure of the interview for the person so she could participate, but it also kind of shifted the messaging of what people with dwarfism were trying to get across in the country of Kenya. And it's a challenge because as someone of short stature, people assume right away, let's treat them like a child or let's pretend they don't have the ability to keep up a conversation in the way that one may think is a normal way of keeping up a conversation. So it is a lot of like, you got to meet people where they are. You have to advocate differently. I think in the workplace specifically, there have been initiatives specific to like finding the strengths within people who have those cognitive disabilities and how we can integrate them into the workforce. But it is different, as you said. And I think as an organization, we try to do the work to advocate on behalf of everyone with the knowledge that you have to meet the needs of the different groups at different times. And I think it's just trying to remind people that there is a range inside the umbrella.
Yeah.
And when we do etiquette training, we try to touch on the different needs of the different communities. So it's not assumed that you treat everyone in the same manner. Obviously, sure. Respect and kindness, but you have to meet people where they are in certain scenarios. And
well, I'd say in every scenario, hopefully, where yes. People are just so inept, they're not able to do it just because they shut down emotionally or they have their own prejudices they can't get over.
Even just with my advocacy, I've done a lot of speaking in schools. There have been some parents of children with dwarfism who have all these like really intense 504 IEP plans, which are just like the special education route for people in schools. And I've had to convince families to get their child back into the mainstream school environment because they're not excelling in that or they're overachieving in that environment and not being stimulated. And I think people just don't know where to put us. So they like put us in that bucket, assuming that we need that much attention, even if we just need one accommodation, like untimed tests.
Yeah. But why would you need that accommodation?
It just because our hands are shorter. So
that would be one of those things that you would have no comprehension of. Why would that be something that you would have more of an... Yeah.
And it's really, it's not untimed. It's time and a half. So it's not that you have all the time in the world. It just gives you a little bit more time to write.
Obviously. And those are the kind of things that are, you'd only know that after having spoken to someone, says, yeah, these would be the limits of where we would have to have more consideration.
Yeah. And like maybe an extra set of books in your classroom so you don't have to carry a heavy bag, but nothing like extreme.
Hmm. You know, when you use the word little people before, that felt like offensive to me. Like, what do you mean little person? You know, like, it's funny. I'm not even the one being offended, but it just feels so like, are there terms through the years which have kind of come in and gone out of style and said, no, this is what we use. This is what we don't use. This is on the out. This is on the going out phase. This is coming up.
I always try to recommend call someone by their name. So just call me Becky.
Exactly.
But sometimes there is an important scenario where it makes sense to educate people a little bit more, maybe even give context before I enter a room. I always use the example of my best friend was inviting me to a bar crawl with a bunch of her friends for the holidays. And they're all from Ireland, and she was worried they were going to have too much beer and say something inappropriate to me. So she gave them a little context ahead of time, which was helpful because then it made it an easier transition. And nothing, they even reacted like, so what's the big deal? So it's almost sometimes people over prepare.
Yeah.
But I would say I'm okay with little person or person of short stature, person with dwarfism. I think the reason I'm okay with little person is because the organization that advocates for people with dwarfism is called Little People of America. But I know I was even doing an interview earlier today and someone like told the audience that that's not an appropriate term. And it was a little offsetting because I didn't say that it wasn't appropriate, but I keep hearing different things. Like I spoke at a school of this girl who she just entered first grade and her family said that she does not like the word dwarf and she likes little person. And it really is personal preference. I would say the word midget is off limits. Like don't use it. But there will be people who will tell you because it may be their upbringing was different and maybe little person and dwarf and every other term was used in an uncomfortable scenario. And yeah, that's the only one left for them to be comfortable with. But yeah, then as we've talked about, there are those assumptions. If someone met someone who was okay with that word, they assume that you're okay with the word. And then it's a spiral again.
Yeah. Maybe they even said, call me this, you know, like they even told them that. So their brain has already been primed that one direction is the correct one.
Dance around it so much. And
That's the issue. That's the, like, if you ask, say, what's the right thing to call you or to name it or whatever. We have a few things that came in. Bolalong, who is a friend from South Africa. He's here every day watching. He says he's a short person. I don't know what that really means if he says he's a short person.
I think below average.
I guess below. I was not a primary, but started noticing it at high school. The other day, I decided to go for a medical checkup. Why I stopped growing, to much amusement to nurses at the clinic. Yeah, I think once you turn Bolalong, once you turn as old as you are, you don't normally go and say, "Listen, why have I stopped growing?" In fact, I would go to the hospital and say, "What's going on with my belly? Why does this keep growing?" That was what I would be doing. Kendra Gottsleben, I don't know if you know her. She's saying, yes, yay, Becky, hello.
Oh, and thank you.
Hey, Bolong is also showing some appreciation for the education today. And Jamie Bishop is agreeing the category of disabled needs to change, or it needs to be maybe have a different categorization within a broader category. Yeah,
maybe we say the umbrella of disability and then the different pieces.
Because exactly like you said before, like that somebody that doesn't have a cognitive disability, right, in your case, would go into a classroom with students that had more cognitive disabilities. You're being educated at the rate of the kids that are having a cognitive, which you don't have. So it would actually, it just, that in my mind has never made any sense.
It was wild when I went to the school. It was a school in New Jersey where there was this family. They were like, this is where our daughter is. And I was like, why is she there? And it was so wonderful watching the transition for her to be challenged in the mainstream.
Yeah. Yeah. You had a question or something?
Well, I was curious. Andy said that he found you on a website where you were asking to be interviewed. And I was wondering, what is your motivation? Is it more to educate the world?
Yeah, I think because there wasn't any representation, any positive representation, when my parents were learning about dwarfism after I was born, I don't think there can ever be enough. Even if there are negative portrayals out there, if we can fog the airways with positive portrayals and representation, we're better off, and it can give hope to the 80% of people with dwarfism who are born into average height families. Mm. And I want to continue to influence those decisions that are being made the day someone was born at the hospital, because, or before someone is even born, but want to continue to be that hope for new parents that their child does have potential and they have to believe in them and allow them to fall and learn on their own, because that's the best thing you can do. But when I was in Kenya, we were having the celebration for people with dwarfism, and it was especially in places like that, it's known for people to hide their children because they don't have the accommodations they need in the schools, or they're only assigned to the doctors in their village who may not be specialists, and they're just feeling shameful and they don't allow them to live to their potential. And I don't want that to happen, because I think everyone has the potential to chase what they're passionate about, whether or not they have a disability. It's important for people not to get in their own way and pursue more.
Yeah, I'd like to think that as we evolve as a species, that we actually begin to think less of disabilities and more like that is something that we need to take into account.
Right.
So when you were talking about the disabilities in the organization you've been working at the past years, like for me, you know, part of the education, clearly things like this are going to educate people so they have a better understanding. Oh, these are the kind of things I don't have to have some stupid imagination or a misfortune as you've had of people projecting onto you that you're some sort of circus clown that you should be performing for them. I mean, that already is idiotic. But that whole idea that basically if someone's going to employ someone that also has, and I'm not going to pronounce the 400th, I'll try it. Achondroplasia.
I think he spelled it right. Achondroplasia.
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 Hey, achondroplasia. That's not so bad.
Akon, the musician.
I don't know.
Achondroplasia.
Achondroplasia. I can do that. Achondroplasia. So that if people are thinking, okay, what are the things I need to consider if I was going to be hiring someone that has an achondroplasia? That I need to think, okay, if they're going to be writing, we need to take that into account. If they're going to be needing to do certain mobility activities, we need to take that into account. But that notwithstanding, then, hey, they would be just like anyone else that we'd hire for this position. Like that's the kind of just clear understanding that once that gets ingrained, then it just, it people stop looking at it as the broad category and then say, oh, disability, we need to hire someone with a disability. Like for me, it becomes nonsensical at some point. It becomes a kind of caricature of itself.
I will say when it comes to parking accommodations, it is recommended for people with dwarfism to get a handicap placard that allows them to park near the building where they're going, because we are at risk for getting run over because people can't see us.
Okay.
And I think when people try to tell us, oh, you don't have a disability, like that is an accommodation that would be helpful for us. When I was working at CBS, I ended up parking right next to the chairman's spot. It was a little nerve-wracking because it was a very nice car that I was very worried about hitting every day. But So there are accommodations, but I would say even when I first started my career, I never asked even for a step stool. It took the workplace to then bring it up like, oh, maybe you could use this. And I never really made a big deal of it, didn't have on my resume that I was a little person. It came with its own challenges as I was trying to enter the workforce because people were surprised when I walked in the room. But most accommodations are less than $500, even for those people who have accommodations that seem more extreme than maybe what I would be asking for. And the other thing is, as you said, hopefully we can just think of it as a criteria. People with disabilities are known to be problem solvers because even when you're waking up in the morning, getting ready to get out of the house, there are so many challenges you face just to, like for me, we just bought a new house, trying to figure out, do we have enough step stools to reach the sinks in the bathroom, to get off the bed and make sure I don't fall down on the floor without landing on my feet? And just things that may come up, or especially in big cities, public transportation, trying to rely on accessible transportation to get places on time. So there are all these things you have to figure out, extra things you have to think about that your average person may not think about when they're just getting out of bed, getting dressed, getting their coffee, getting in the car, and getting to work.
Well, Becky, thank you. I honestly have to say I was just, not because of this show. I'm just tired. I've been tired. The show, we've done so many of these that I needed a show where I felt like, wow, I really got a lot out of that. And I really am grateful for you because I really do feel like, wow, I feel like I learned a lot this show. An eye-opening experience for me.
Yeah.
So you
I got the energy from this.
I'm deeply grateful for you giving me some joy today. So I'm thanking you for that now.
Well, thank you.
Fascinating. I don't know if on these shows I feel like I learn as much as I learned on today's show.
I learn every day.
I mean, I learn, but there are just things I just was not aware of, or things that came up. I just thought, well, okay. Especially with having kids and thinking in terms of percentage chances and all of that, that was really eye-opening for me. The kind of considerations you wouldn't think about.
Yeah, and for me, what became really apparent is how it's in our DNA to create separation.
Yeah. And what do you mean by that?
Well, in the size and the color of the skin. Like I was thinking today, a friend of mine, she's in Africa. She wants to visit Europe.
Okay.
And she, I mean, even before COVID, she had such a hard time just getting a fucking visa to come over.
Oh, yeah.
And it's skin color.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's always something that separates us.
Yeah.
And we look for the things that are dissimilar and not the things that are similar.
Yeah.
Which is kind of why I love this show, is that for me, as far as I'm concerned, everyone that comes on, we're all the same. And we just have a different experience and we get to share that. That's what makes us all have a little bit more compassion.
It's a wonderful chaos.
We like it that.